The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you, when they probably never have told you turn the other cheek. And they made it with a bat, fucking protesting them citizens. Told you go fight in the war, Vietnam, you died, good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around a pump crack right up and you did it. And they just turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called the National Guard up because we ride with our guard up. And that was blood in your guard. The Second Amendment don't apply to you. Everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue.
One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. The one that you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
Good afternoon. You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines, known as USA Inc. Today's date is December the 22nd, 2015. It is a Tuesday afternoon. We do have a guest scheduled for you today. Hopefully it'll go a lot better. Well, I'm sure our guest will be joining us today, as our guest yesterday was a no-show. And again, I want to apologize for that, but today we are scheduled in just about 8 minutes to speak with author and activist Sikivu Hutchison about her latest book, which is titled White Knights and Black Paradise. Now, this book is about the tragedy of Jonestown. I was like in junior high, I believe, in middle school in Detroit back in 1978, where some people call it a mass murders, others call it a massacre, and others call it a mass suicide. So a lot of people today may not even recall the story of Jonestown, which was, of course, led by the religious leader by the name of Jim Jones. Jonestown, the actual name of the religious, I guess we could call it a cult. I would call it a cult. I don't know about other people, but I would call it a cult. But it was actually known as the People's Temple Agricultural Project. And again, it was also known as Jonestown. And the massacre, the mass suicide, the mass murder, whatever label you want to subscribe to it based on your analysis of the details, occurred in northwestern Guyana, which, of course, is in Africa. And so, I mean, there are just so many things that we could look at as pertaining to, you know, this white male, Jim Jones. And, you know, I did not know because, again, I was a child at the time, and this isn't really talked about, and I haven't looked at any documentaries on Jim Jones or the People's Temple Agricultural Project. So, you know, I did refresh myself on it today. But, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is, you know, how a lot of different people in my social circles or people I have read about talk about exodus out of the United States and establishing, if you will, a colony in Africa and going over to Africa, the homeland of African descended people, and trying to escape racism and white supremacy. And that is really the backdrop of the People's Temple Agricultural Project, which, of course, was led by this white person. But as Ms. Hutchison points out in this book, White Knights, Black Paradise, that mostly black women were a part of that movement and recruiting others to that movement. So we will have a discussion with her today concerning black women, religion, and, of course, Jonestown, which is the backdrop of her book. And so, again, we'll be speaking to her here in just a bit. If you have any questions or comments, and she won't be joining us via video chat, but she'll be joining us by phone. But if you have any questions or comments, please get those on early, as we are only scheduled to speak with her for about 20 minutes. So that'll be up until 4:30, and then I'll take my first station identification break. So get those questions and comments in early. You can contact the program two different ways. There is, well, actually three different ways. The conference line number is 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549032#. Greetings to those already dialed in. Anytime you would like to ask a question, make a comment, share observation, just hit *6 and 1 and we'll get you on air. You can also give us a call via the studio line, which is 704-951-5030. Again, that's the studio line. That's 704-951-5030. And you can also join us via the video chat for those who are watching via our Blab account. And you can also, via Blab, there's a chat room there that you can submit your questions or your comments or observations. And we'll share those with the listening audience. After our interview, after we speak to Ms. Hutchison, do want to look at some of the social and political news of the day. I know last night I shared a story on our Facebook page, Black Talk Radio Network, about Sandra Bland, and the jury has failed to indict anyone in her jailhouse death. So we can take a look at that story. Also, I saw a story today concerning Tamir Rice and just how long it has taken for a grand jury to even be convened in that case of a 12-year-old being shot within seconds of contact with police officers in Cleveland, Ohio, who had gotten a report of a young person, trying to recall the 911 caller, but the 911 caller did say that they possibly had a toy gun and was pointing at people. And most people who are familiar with the story know that the Cleveland, two police officers with the Cleveland Police Department arrived on the scene and within seconds gunned this child down. And it has been over a year now. And it's just been a long, drawn-out process, purposely so, in my opinion, by the prosecutor to not, you know, do everything he can to not even try to indict these people. And again, as I've heard many people say, the old saying goes, you know, if a prosecutor wanted to, they could indict a ham sandwich. And so, you know, I guess they don't want to indict. In many cases, they don't. They don't want to indict these police officers. And that's something I was thinking about in a wider context, in that, you know, the prosecutor's office, the police, all of that, they're supposed to be separate entity. Obviously, they have separate budgets, but they act like, you know, they work within the same office. And so, you know, there is a conflict of interest there. There's a lot of impropriety going on in the process. And, you know, the bigger question is how do we solve that? I think that, you know, the system is only as good as the people working in it. If you have corrupt people working in the system, well, then, you know, since they are in these positions, then the system is going to be corrupt. But we have seen cases where, you know, the system in terms of getting indictments and whatnot has worked. It has worked. But in terms of police killing civilians, you know, a lot of times, you know, it does not work. And that all depends on the prosecutor's relationship with police unions, whom they need to get elected. So, you know, those are some of the things that's on my radar as pertaining to, you know, news stories that's kind of important that could lead us into a wider discussion. So let me make sure that my guest line is open. And of course, it is open. So we should be joined by Ms. Sakivu Hutchison in just any moment now, where we will be discussing her latest book, again, which is titled White Knights, Black Paradise. So I think we have her calling in now. Let's go ahead and take this call. Greetings, Mrs. Hutchison. Do we have you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Greetings to you. And, you know, I have been pronouncing your name correctly. My listeners know that I sometimes have that trouble, so I'm glad I was able to talk to you early. But we want to, at this time, welcome Sakivu Hutchison to come on and talk about her latest book titled White Knights, Black Paradise, again, which is about the tragedy of Jonestown. Before we get started, Ms. Hutchison, could you give our listeners just a little bit of background about yourself so they'll know a little bit about the activist and artist, excuse me, author, Sakivu Hutchison?
Be happy to. I'm based in Los Angeles. I'm an educator. I also work with the LA County Human Relations Commission on youth leadership development and outreach to local schools. I have a young women's leadership project, which is a feminist humanist civic engagement mentoring program based in South LA. And I've been an author for the past couple of decades. My first book was Imagining Transit, Race and Gender Politics in Los Angeles. Next book was Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, Gender Values War. This is the first book to be written by an African-American woman on atheism and secular humanism.
Thank you for sharing that information. And let me ask you this question before we get into the meat of the interview. As I mentioned to the listeners, I was very young. I was in middle school in 1978 when the tragedy of Jonestown occurred in Guyana, Africa. And, you know, I know it's not polite to ask a woman her age and whatnot. But, you know, how old were you when this occurred? Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners, and especially the younger listeners, may have heard of Jonestown, but, you know, they probably don't remember when it occurred. I actually remember, you know, some news reports about it at the time and listening to the adults in my family talk about the tragedy. But, you know, since then, I haven't heard a lot about it until, you know, you contacted us and, you know, I took a look at your book.
Right. So to answer your first question, I was 9 when the tragedy occurred on November 18th, 1978. And the thing to remember about Jonestown, and I was actually in South America, Guyana, South America, that it occurred in a period when there was obviously a lot of turmoil. It was the largest murder-suicide in American history. Over 900 people perished during the tragedy. 300 of which were children, and the majority of those who died were African-American women. So the church that was involved at Jonestown, it was an independent settlement that was developed by People's Temple Church beginning in the early 1970s. This church was over 75% African-American. And one of the things that compelled me to do research and then write a book on Jonestown People's Temple was the fact that the majority of the representations, both nonfiction and fiction, that have been done on the tragedy have come from a white perspective, mm-hmm. and have really focused on white protagonists and white figures that were involved in People's Temple. So I felt that it was really important to bring forward the black women's voices and the black women's struggles within the People's Temple movement, because, again, nearly 50% of those who died at Jonestown were black women.
In a wider context of religion, and you shared, but just to reiterate the point, did you also write this from a secularist point of view or an atheist point of view? How did you approach this project?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say yes and no.
Okay.
On the one hand, I was trying to convey the complexity of People's Temple because, though it started out as a Pentecostal church with a strong emphasis on faith healing, it morphed into a secular, atheist, agnostic, humanist, and, you know, every other, I guess, secularist designation under the sun. So that intrigued me, you know, the fact that you have the predominantly African-American church with a white pastor who identified as a radical Marxist, and later on identified as African American, you know, actually proclaimed his blackness in the early 70s. And it was a church, again, of many different belief systems. But the most prominent of those belief systems, you know, toward the end of the church's trajectory, was an atheist secularist emphasis. So I have characters in the novel, black women characters, that espouse those beliefs.
Now, the characters that are in the book, and how would you describe the book as historical fiction? How would you describe it?
Yeah, historical / literary fiction.
Okay.
So I attempted to obviously look at the history of People's Temple to situate it within the context of the late 1950s into the 1970s, because the church was created in 1956, and this was obviously at the height of Jim Crow, right around the time of the Montgomery bus boycott. Jones established it in Indianapolis, and Indianapolis during this period was basically Klan country, very segregationist, very separated when it came to religion and faith. And so in many regards, People's Temple was an outlier. It was an anomaly in a highly apartheid-oriented community, where you had an interracial church, a white pastor, reaching out to African-Americans from all walks of life, but primarily working class and low-income African-Americans, had a social justice ethos, provided a number of different programs for the elderly, for foster care, for indigent populations in Indianapolis, and then when it branched out into California, relocating in Ukiah, California, and Northern California, and then San Francisco, and then L.A., it really redoubled its efforts as far as, being engaged in trying to help disenfranchise communities of color.
Now, your novel, White Knights, Black Paradise, seems to have three main characters who are black women. And you mentioned that you did research. This isn't like straight fiction. It's a fictional novel, but it's based on actual historical events. So in focusing on those three black characters, those black women, were they based on any actual real people that were a part of this? Or, are they a combination of, let's say, types of people who would be attracted to such a religious institution?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the majority of the characters are composite characters. The protagonists are two African-American sisters, one of which is a lesbian atheist, the other is straight agnostic. And so the novel really turns on the complexity and the substance of their relationship, how they interact with People's Temple, what motivated them to get involved, and ultimately what compelled them to migrate to Jonestown, along with a number of other African-American women members who were coming from all walks of life, all sexual orientations, all classes, all professions, and motivated by a myriad things. So this is what I attempted to capture in the novel, the fact that debunking the stereotype of the image of People's Temple with regard to what compelled black women, what was really the motivating factor. It wasn't just that they were bowing down, to this crazed, white authoritarian, dictator religious figure.
White
but
savior.
They had their own subjectivity when it came to investing in People's Temple Church, as a political effort, and then immigrating to Jonestown as really an act of self-determination. As an act of pushing back against what they perceive to be the manifest institutionalized injustice in white supremacy in the United States. So, I tried to humanize and to really rationalize their choices and their decisions in a way that I don't believe has been done in the reams and reams of material that's been produced on Jonestown to the detriment of People's Temple.
Would you say that those type of people that you base these characters on, and again, I note that you said, the women had various reasons for going, but even today, as a reaction to racism and white supremacy, which is a global system, but, you know, many feel like, you know, it is really based right here in or emanating from the United States out to the rest of the world. And, you know, there are a number of people within what we will call the black community who talk about migrating back to Africa, getting out of the United States to flee from racism and white supremacy. So do you see similar attitudes today among black women, black people in general, that you discovered, you know, among these people who are part of the People's Temple?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the People's Temple immigration can really be situated within the whole array of black diasporic travel and black diasporic imaginings in an attempt to recuperate a sense of self and identity separate and apart from the white supremacist dehumanizing trajectory of the United States. And so it was really important for me, as a black feminist author, to try and capture that, to try and contextualize black women's perspective on the church and on the notion of immigrating vis-a-vis the Great Migration and the fact that you had so many African-American women who were involved in People's Temple, who came from the Deep South, who came from, you know, the virtually apartheid Midwest and moved to San Francisco, moved to Los Angeles with this notion that these cities were going to be spaces of equal opportunity, that they were going to allow, you know, black women, you know, to fully realize, you know, their value as human beings, as citizens. And in a sense, Jonestown was an encapsulation, you know, of all those dreams, hopes, ambitions, and imaginings.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like they were seeking something that I've heard today among the college students in creating safe spaces for black people. Indeed, our network was created as a digital safe space for black people interested in producing digital radio, as we had experienced racism and white supremacy on some of the other platforms that we were on before Black Talk Radio Network was created. So it sounds like to me that they were seeking a safe space for black people.
Absolutely. And the tragedy of it is that you did have, you know, a white male leader mm-hmm. who preyed upon, mm-hmm. who exploited, you know, that desire and that dream among African Americans, mm-hmm. you know, who really perpetuated, you know, this image that this place was going to be a racial utopia and an antidote to the Holocaust that went down in the United States. And so that's the tragic downside, you know, of People's Temple and Jonestown, that was very much part of the cultural propaganda, you know, that was perpetuated by the white leadership of that church. And so a lot of those tensions surface in the relationships in the novel, you know, in terms of the lead protagonist protesting, you know, and resisting, and in some instances, you know, being complicit with that structure. So I wanted to convey the nuances of that, the ambiguity of that, and to allow those folk who might not have had, you know, that initial experience with Jonestown, you know, as youngsters or as adults, you know, to enter into the space and put some context to the travails of these women, you know, place it within a 21st century, a context in terms of, let's look at, you know, I mean, all of the horrors that African Americans have experienced in the so-called, you know, post-racial, colorblind, meritocratic space, where, you know, we have the least wealth of any group in the U.S. We're more segregated now. You know, we're being pipelined into prisons, you know, ad nauseum, ad infinitum. And so, circling back to 1978, you know, where you're at the tail end of the Black Power movement, you know, the tail end of the civil rights movement, you know, the ripening of the women's movement, as well as, you know, the gay liberation movement, you know, at the intersection of all these different movements, that you had this element of hope and, you know, ambition around establishing this independent settlement outside of the U.S. within a Black-led socialist English-speaking country where black people could be affirmed and validated as who they were. So that was really at the core of what motivated black people to immigrate there.
And all of this is captured and conveyed in your book, White Nights, Black Paradise?
Yes.
Yes.
I believe so.
Well, you mentioned Jim Jones preying upon these black women. And, you know, that was one of the questions that was in my mind as I was listening to you speak. And when you said that, you know, why? And you mentioned that over 50% of the People's Temple were black women. In your research, why is that? Did he seek out and target black women, or was it something that he was doing that black women were attracted to the movement? And what was the representation of black males?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So I would say that in its initial period in the late 1950s, yes, you know, there was heavy recruitment, you know, of black folk with regard to attempting to lift up social welfare programs, you know, that could enfranchise and empower working class African American communities in Indianapolis. When they transitioned to California, they connected with black organizations like the Black Panthers, like the Nation of Islam, like Live Memorial Church, which is a progressive African American church in San Francisco. So they made a big push, you know, towards you know, actively recruiting and mobilizing African Americans from all walks of life. There was a period in the 1960s when Jones attempted to hook up with Father Divine in Chicago, you know, and take over, you know, Father Divine's congregation, and that failed. So he always had this impulse of trying to galvanize African Americans, because he came from a very poor, you know, white working class background, a labor aligned background. Embraced, as I said before, you know, Marxist socialist principles. And so this was something that was a key part of his own personal, political, and ideological ethos that informed the church's ethos. And as far as African American male membership was concerned, you know, obviously their numbers were less than black women's, but they were also there in strong numbers. You know, they constituted what was known as the Red Brigade, which was, you know, the temple guard structure, where, you know, they would, you know, watch over the church, and they would do security. And some of these young men primarily identified with Jones as a father figure. Hmm. The other interesting aspect about People's Temple was that it was very communal. So there were temple collectives, you know, where people, you know, could live and have room and board and all their needs taken care of, through tithing, of course. Members were required to tithe over 20% of their incomes and their assets to the church. So a really key part of White Nights, Black Paradise is articulating how much went into propping up People's Temple's financial empire, its financial foundation. Black women powered People's Temple, you know, through their income, through their social security benefits, welfare benefits, disability benefits, property. So these are all things that were critical, you know, to keeping the church in motion. And then, of course, I get into the culture of violence and terrorism that emerged in the 1960s, and obviously that precipitated the mass murder suicide on November 18th, 1978.
Now, as I was, you know, just researching for this interview and just refreshing my memory on what occurred, I didn't actually know why you named your book White Nights in Black Paradise. But White Nights actually is the term that is used to describe the mass murder slash suicide pact. And so, you know, what did you find in your research, or what conclusions did you come to? And, you know, do you express this in the book, the mindset that would lead so many people, up to 900 people, to commit suicide, and not just of themselves, you know, adults, but their children?
Right, right. So a couple things I want to clarify is that it was a complex event insofar as there were people who chose to take the cyanide flavor aid cocktail, and it was not Kool-Aid, contrary to the misnomer that's been propagated all these decades.
Okay.
There were those who chose to partake. There were those who were forced to partake, and there were those who were according to some autopsy reports, forcibly injected with the poison. Mm-hmm. So it's important to underscore that it was not an entirely elective event.
He actually did a test run.
Yes, that's another important aspect that's brought out in the novel, that this was part of a culture of suicide. It was part of a culture of loyalty tests that were imposed upon members in order to reinforce their allegiance to the temple. So these suicide drills began as early as the late 1960s. Mm. You know, this was not some novel thing that, that just materialized out of nowhere on November 18th.
Mm-hmm.
The White Knight was the signifier of siege, of racial terrorism and siege on the settlement. So White Knight drills were designed to try and whip up a frenzy among settlement members to, you know, have them patrol the settlements, to try and weed out, you know, potential traitors, mm-hmm. to more or less reinforce, you know, allegiance and obeisance to People's Temple and the Jonestown hierarchy. So there was always this threat that we are going to be invaded by these racial terrorists, by these colonialists. They're going to come and, you know, basically uproot us, you know, to potentially murder us, to wipe us out and to undermine our way of life and, you know, our allegiance to multiracialism and socialism and black self-determination. That was a big part of the Temple ethos.
It just seems very odd as we get ready to wrap up our interview. And again, I appreciate you taking the time out to speak with us today. But it just seems all very odd to talk about black self-determination under white leadership. I mean, that's sort of like an oxymoron to me, but I don't know. How
Absolutely.
Does, yeah.
So the way that that was reconciled is that as early as the late 1960s, Jones began to disavow his whiteness by proclaiming that he was effectively of African descent.
Okay.
So, you know, there's one, you know, really bombastic sermon where he talks about the Bible. This is a direct quote. The Bible was the thing that brought us. It is what they used to rip us out of the rich lands of Africa and put us into chains as they are still doing 400 years later. So, you know, he makes these definitive statements about his blackness, you know, his alignment, you know, with black social history and with black leadership and with black identity and black nationalism that is critically important for drawing in and tethering the African-American membership.
In conclusion, for those who purchase your book, White Knights, Black Paradise, what are some of the major lessons that they will learn from this book, and how can they apply it in their lives? Because, you know, I got to say that, you know, this sort of thing, it could happen again.
Yeah. I think the overriding one is to be respectful of the richness and the complexity and the nuances of black women's lives, you know, within an extremely turbulent context.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen that vis-a-vis Jonestown. The other one is to have some critical perspective on organized religion and false idols and charismatic leaders. And we certainly know that the cult of the charismatic religious leader mm-hmm. has been very seductive for many African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 87% of black women are religiously aligned, go to church on a regular basis, you know, tithe a significant portion of their incomes, despite the fact that we have the least wealth among any group in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So it was important for me to foreground that in a subtle way in the narrative. But the overriding, I would hope, message and takeaway would be that black women did not enter into this movement, and it was a movement, with their eyes closed, with blinders on, you know, as gullible acolytes and sheep.
Okay.
There were specific socio-historical reasons, as well as personal reasons, of course, that compelled them to become involved, to invest their lives, and in many instances, you know, their incomes, what little wealth they had, you know, to commit their families to this movement. And yes, it was a tragedy insofar as you had nearly 1,000 people who perished. But it's important to place this within specific historical context where black women are constantly being dehumanized, mm-hmm. marginalized, and made to be invisible.
Mm. Do you think that makes them right for exploitation?
Well, I would say that it makes African American women more vulnerable.
More vulnerable. Okay.
And certainly organized religion has been a space where that vulnerability has been capitalized on, but it's also been a space where black women have exercised a lot of agency, have exercised leadership, you know, have come to voice. And, you know, as an atheist, from a black feminist perspective, that's something that I value on the one hand, but mm-hmm. I'm also deeply critical of on the other.
Okay.
So I recognize that the dialectical nature of, you know, black women's investment in organized religion and these kinds of splinter, you know, religious organizations.
Well, Ms. Hutchison, again, thank you. Before you leave us, where can people purchase? Where do you recommend they go to purchase White Nights, Black Paradise, and to also take a look at some of your other works?
You can go to my website, SakibuHutchison.com. You can also obviously go to Amazon. And I'm hoping to work with more independent black-owned bookstores to get the title there. It's available in Los Angeles at Esalon Bookstore currently.
And they can contact you through the website.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you. Thank you again, Mitch Hutchison. And I hope, you know, this is your first time on our network and on this program. And I hope it will not be the last time.
Yes, I deeply appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You have a good day, ma'am.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, that concludes our interview with Ms. Hutchison. And, you know, the reason that I decided to do this interview, because it does touch upon what I feel like is a contemporary topic or area in terms of black people all over the globe, but primarily here in the United States. And we kind of touched upon that, on how organized religion plays such a major role in the lives of black people. And I would have to say primarily black women. I can just look at my own family and see that. And, you know, I live right next door to a church, and it the membership of that church, and every church I've ever, when I was participating in organized religion, every church I belong to has always been predominantly black women. And so very interesting conversation. I do encourage you to get the book White Nights, Black Paradise, as it touches upon a lot of deep aspects of the black community, especially when I look at, you know, the contradiction of black self-determination under white leadership. And again, this can happen today. I mean, even, and those who are longtime listeners of the program, those who have read some of the articles I have written about Tim Wise, you know, and I have several issues with Tim Wise, but I see that same sort of thing, that same sort of dynamic, the way I have observed a lot of black women, mainly the way they gush over Tim Wise. I actually had called Tim Wise out for giving people incorrect information when this was in the wake of the Hebdo Charlie massacre that occurred in Paris, France, and the whole issue of First Amendment speech and free speech rights came up. And in that context, he had said, you know, in America, I suppose that, you know, a person has a right to use racial slurs against someone and not be murdered for it. And, you know, he said he supposes he has a right to stand in Times Square and, you know, yell racial slurs at people. And I wrote an article about that, you know, saying that Tim Wise supposes that he has the right to stand in the middle of the street, or he has the right to yell nigger in the street. And so he took issue with that. But the premise of the article was looking at the factual information. I did research on the history of the First Amendment in the context of the Bill of Rights, in the context of the U.S. Constitution, and a lot of people falsely believe that they have a First Amendment speech right to verbally and racially abuse people, and that, you know, they just have an absolute right to do that. And it's not. It's not true. And that was an infactual statement. And for someone, you know, and while I value education, titles like PhDs and all that kind of stuff don't impress me. It really doesn't. And so, but I would think that a learned person, before issuing such a statement, especially with the audience that he has, will actually do some research on the First Amendment. It took me less than probably 3 hours to complete my research on that. And then I also uncovered laws that specifically address that, you know, racial intimidation in various states. They have laws, racial intimidation, harassment. It also could fall up under stalking. And this was actually a Supreme Court case. And I can't recall the name of the case, but it occurred in the early 1900s, where this guy had called this police officer a bunch of names. And that's where the term fighting words come from. You know, when you know, a lot of times black people will tell you, I'll punch you in the mouth if you want to call me the N-word, because those are fighting words. Well, that's where that term fighting words comes from. And the Supreme Court determined that Kavinsky, I think that was his name, the guy's name, Kavinsky, did not have a right to verbally abuse that police officer. And they called it, you know, fighting words, that, you know, these are words that are meant to disturb the peace. And so, again, this dynamic of so-called black self-determination under white leadership, you know, I see that same dynamic playing out with the followers of Tim Wise. You know, like, I need a white suspected racist, and I do suspect him of practicing racism and whatnot. We looking at these people like, you know, they're our saviors or something, or we need them to talk to us about racism. No, he needs to talk to white people about confronting racism. He don't need to talk to the victims. But that's primarily who his audience is black women. Those are the number one buyers of his books. Those are the ones that's paying his big money to go to his lectures and to tell them something that they should already know for themselves. And so, again, you know, I'm looking at Jonestown in that aspect as well. So, again, we do want to thank our guest, Ms. Hutchison, for joining us. Again, her book is titled White Knights, Black Paradise. Links to her website as well as to the Amazon listing of her book is contained in our program notes on blacktalkradionetwork.com. I do want to take a station identification just to let you know about some of the upcoming program today, live programming today on Black Talk Radio Network. Coming up at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, Brother Dave, who is the host of the Tando Radio Show, will be on air, and they will be talking about the financial markets again and looking at Greece. And Brother Dave says that Greece is sort of like, we can look at Greece as a, I don't know if I'm using this word correctly, bellwether, or like a canary in a coal mine. You know, they used to put canaries in a coal mine to detect, you know, carbon monoxide. And if the canaries died, you know, then that was like, you know, your early warning system and whatnot. And so they will be talking about Greece as a canary for world financial markets, the financial system, the collapse of capitalism, and, you know, what people can expect, you know, to happen where they live, like primarily here in the United States, with its capitalist system really being in trouble. And Brother Day talked about that a lot on the program yesterday. And so that'll be a continued conversation today as they take a look at, you know, some of the things that's happening in Greece and how those things can happen or are happening right here in the United States. Tonight is Tuesday night. One of our media partners, Why You Mad Son Radio, comes on usually at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. It's a bit early, so I can't tell you what they will be talking about. I don't think they have put out their program notes yet, but they usually, without fail, are on air on the Black Talk Radio Network every Tuesday night at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. You can find out all this information about upcoming programming, blog posts, and whatnot by following our social media accounts. We are on Twitter at Black Talk Radio. We as well as on Facebook. Our Facebook page is Black Talk Radio Network. And of course, we publish everything on our website, blacktalkradionetwork.com, which then gets disseminated out to the social networks. I'm going to take a station identification break, play a little bit of message music, and then we'll come back. We'll take a look at some of the news today that's in the headlines today. A couple of things I want to take a look at. Again, if you have not heard, a jury refused to indict anyone concerned with the jailhouse death of Sandra Bland. I'll take a look at one of the articles that I shared and share some of those details with you. Also, there are some other things that I like to share with you that we publish and share with those who follow us on our various social media accounts. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. Of course, I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines that I call USA Inc. And we will be right back on the other side.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States. And more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That's power right there, if we know how to prove.
We should own and operate and control the economy of our community. We have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a rundown community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar.
We've got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money there. You have six or seven black insurance companies here. Take out your insurance there. Now, these are some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a greater economic base. We've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. We've got to see it through.
So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community, what we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community.
The black man must unite in one grand racial hierarchy, making a racial empire upon which the sun shall never set. Be black, buy black, be black, and all of them together with
American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed in for this broadcast. And as I stated before we went to break and at the beginning of the program, a grand jury has issued no indictments in the jailhouse death of Sandra Bland. I want to share with you at this time this brief report, some audio from this video report by NBCNews.com, NBCNews.com. If you would like a link to this article, I'll go ahead and share that in the chat room. It has been shared on our social media page, Black Talk Radio Network, on Facebook as well. So let me see if I can cue this up and take a listen. I think the family members are also speaking here, or an attorney for the family. I'm just trying to give this video a chance to load up.
One of the things, though, with this non-indictment,
I don't think anybody should be surprised. Now, again, you know, this brings up the question of, well, what was presented to the grand jury? What was the evidence in the case? Which I think, you know, in terms of knowing those type of details, we really don't have those kind of details. But I'm not surprised, regardless of the evidence or whatnot, or what wasn't presented. I'm not surprised that there was no indictment that was issued. In fact, you know, we do host a Wednesday night program that comes on 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time on Black Talk Radio Network, and we're trying to incorporate the video simulcast of that. But we talk about New Abolitionist Radio. We talk about 21st century slavery and human trafficking and all the deaths that are occurring in prisons and jails across this country. So, you know, I don't think people really have a true grasp of how big this problem is with people being killed in prison or dying due to medical neglect. I just remember, you know, from yesterday sharing an article and reading an article about all the prison deaths and predominantly at the hands of guards that occur in the state of Florida. Florida is especially brutal when it comes to prisoners. And we have highlighted on this network several stories. And the majority of the victims, of course, are always black. But, I mean, a number of them have been white as well. I can't even get the image, you know, that image of the white male who was gassed to death. That's what we call it. When they, you know, threw that gas in there, I'm trying to think of the proper terminology for it. But, you know, they use pepper spray and stuff like that. And they use so much on this young white man that, you know, the walls of his cell were just coated with this yellow substance that I would call it mustard gas, man. That's what it reminds me of, this thick yellow substance. And then the outline of his body as he was against the wall trying to shield himself, and, you know, obviously he died and whatnot, and that was murder, and how they cover up these things. So I'm not surprised. You know, again, I have to be honest, and I also have to be objective. I haven't really seen or heard anybody writing about any of the evidence that would suggest everything that has been put out by corporate media. Everything I have heard, you know, they talk about the evidence that supports a lend support to the suicide theory. But again, you know, I don't trust media. That is why I created, you know, the Black Talk Radio Network in 2008, based on my research of, you know, the media is not, more times than not, it is not being straightforward and truthful. And a lot of times they just try to push whatever the police story is. If we're talking about a police department or a jail, you know, the administrators of the jail, or whether it's the United States government, you know, I will remind people, you know, we look back at the Iraq war, and I'm not talking about the Gulf War, but, you know, when George Bush invaded Iraq. Well, I shouldn't say he invaded it because he was sitting safe and sound here in the United States. But when he ordered the invasion of Iraq, most of the mainstream media pretty much without question was advancing all of those lies of the Bush-Cheney regime and putting all this false evidence out there. And they really didn't even question it. So I just am highly distrustful of the mainstream media, although I do use them to gather information, gather intelligence, and then we have to sort it out. What's true, what's likely to be true, what's likely to be false. So, you know, reading news articles should not be that hard, but, you know, it is, unfortunately, if you are a person where, you know, discerning truth from fiction is important to you. So let's go ahead and roll this. I think it's ready. Let's see.
Wow. Get out of the car.
For a failure to signal. You
get over there.
Right, yeah. Let's see if I can get that audio up a little higher.
For a failure to signal. Get up.
The grand jury considered the evidence and no indictment was returned on the death of Sandra Bland, as well as no indictment was returned for any of the staff at the Waller County Jail. We have left no rock unturned. In the grand jury, anything that they've asked for, we've done our best to get it to them. This is a very serious process, and, you know, I'm not trying to be coy, but I'm trying to protect the process. And so I'm just trying to maintain the integrity of the process, because as you can see, even while the process was going on, people were saying they were having faith and had no idea what we were doing. So I'm just trying to make sure we stay above board.
All right. That sounded like a black spokesperson for the prosecutor's department and whatnot. So, you know, just very short information. Look, again, I have to always be honest and objective, you know, so I can maintain my credibility. I don't know what the evidence is. I don't know. Again, a lot of these grand jury proceedings are secret, and there's a lot of conversations around whether or not they should be secret. I do understand the history of why they became secret, so that people will feel free to come forth and give testimony. But again, you know, how are you going to indict someone if those people aren't willing to testify publicly, which you would need them to do that if you get an indictment and a trial? So, you know, that whole process needs to be looked at, perhaps retooled. But again, as I opened up the program, I was just talking about all the failings of that. You know, it's pretty easy, as people have said, you know, it's pretty easy to get for a prosecutor to get an indictment. Unless there are racial dynamics at play, then the makeup of the jury comes in and whatnot. And then, you know, the racial classification of the victim, all these things, and those who are, you know, being accused of the wrongdoing, whether it's a murder or whatnot. So, you know, I don't have a whole lot of information. I haven't seen anybody that has really talked about this. And again, you know, these grand juries are sworn to secrecy. And so you would think that, you would hope that if you are going to seek an indictment, that you had some evidence to suggest that a crime has been committed. So the very fact that the prosecution sought an indictment means that they must have had evidence to suggest that a crime has been committed. But I haven't really seen anything coming out of the prosecutor's office to that effect, you know, and making announcements and whatnot, and why we're seeking this indictment and whatnot. So again, the system is very flawed. And then also on top of the flaws of the system and the process, it depends on humans. It depends on humans. Humans, of course, are imperfect, infallible. Some are even, you know, just straight up evil. and corrupt and whatnot. And so, you know, the system can only be as good as the people that make up the system that are in these positions. So this is something I suspect more people will be talking about. As I learn more information about the case, I will share it with you. It looks like we have a call. Let's go ahead and take this call. Area code 267. Thank you for joining us on Black Talk Radio News. Go ahead with your question, comment, or observation.
Hey, good evening, Scotty. This is Brother Ralph calling from Philadelphia. How are you?
I'm not going to complain too much, Brother Ralph, because I'm sure there's a lot of people doing worse than me. So I usually come on these airways to complain for them. So what's on your mind today? Thank you for joining us.
Man, you stirred up a lot of feelings with your guests. I listened to her. Matter of fact, I about to cut on YouTube and after you go off and watch a few of these documentaries on
Jonestown.
Jim Jones. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's not unbelievable, Scotty, because when I used to go to that, and you know, you get me wrong a lot of times when I do come down on religion, because mm-hmm. I see what it did to people firsthand, mm-hmm. that I used to go to that building. I was raised in a religion, mm-hmm. and I used to go in there, and I see what it does to people, especially black women. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say, well, in that part of the world, if there was a person named Jesus, would he look like that, that image that you're looking at? They said that, but what they'll tell you is they don't care what image that he comes in. I mean, they will.
Then why have an image on the wall at all, then, Brother Ralph?
But then why have an image at all? And, you know, I had just posted a picture of Charles Manson dressed in a Jesus outfit, mm-hmm. And said, if this man knocked on your door, would you let him in? Mm-hmm. Now, and I think some of them was up to, they know how I feel about religion. So none of them, they stayed away from my page. But I was trying to make a point. Mm-hmm. Because if they didn't know how I felt about religion, they would have been all on there, amen, yes, I'll let them in, and this, that, and the other, without even knowing that was Charles Manson. Mm-mm-mm. So, you know, the thing about it, here's my personal experience with this, Scotty, and I only speak from my experience. That way I'm not guessing, it's not my opinion, I'm only giving you my experience.
Okay.
I was in a church. And it was not really a mega church, but it had about maybe 1,000, 2,000 members. They had a lot of members.
That's a mega church,
and,
bro.
Well, if that's what you want to call it. But it had a lot of members, man. And what happened? He brought this guy in there called Mike Murdoch. And I said, look at this swindler here. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. I went there because maybe I can get a few, you know, I was like right on the fence then. I was stepping out of religion because I mm-hmm. always searched through religion and I always ran into a brick wall with it. Mm-hmm. There was always something that was garbage that they were trying to force feed me, and I stepped away from it. I've been in the Nation of Islam, Christianity, Black Hebrew Israelites, all of it. And all of it, I've learned some things, but, you know, my experiences are my experiences. So when they bought this devil in there, man, you start hearing his violin music, and his whole sermon was on money. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I mean, right from the start. Now, I stood there and I watched how emotional these black women got over this white man standing there talking about money. Mm-hmm. And I said, there's a problem. But so if Jim Jones would come today, preach a charismatic gospel sermon that get them falling all over the place, then they'll follow him.
Yeah, that's why I brought up the example.
They would follow him, Scotty.
That's why I brought up the example of Tim Wise.
One of my best friends, and she's still a good friend of mine today. I love the whole family. Gave up her whole income tax check to this guy.
Wow.
And when he wrote her this letter, she was so proud of it. Mm-mm-mm. Until her sister told her, I gave him $20, and he wrote me the same letter. Mm-mm-mm. And she had a disabled husband, 3 children, and it was really pathetic, Scotty. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this stuff really hurts, and it hurts deep down when I continuously see our folks in these buildings giving up their hard-earned money. And it's women. Hard-headed, stubborn. Well, I'm going to call them like I see them. Hard-headed, stubborn,
you know,
women that you can't even talk to.
You know, I have
they won't listen to you, brother.
I have a...
Go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, I have a story to illustrate that point about stubbornness. Okay, because I'm like you, grew up in the church. At one time, I almost became an ordained minister. I still hold on to my spiritual beliefs, but I no longer participate in organized religion. But at one time, that's all I studied was the Bible and other religious teachings and whatnot. And you know, when I read Hebrews chapter 7, and my interpretation of Hebrews chapter 7 is that the priesthood was done away with the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, and therefore the tithing was done away with, because the whole point of tithing was to support the priesthood. And I talked about this on a prior broadcast, but then when I started talking to family members and even showing them in the Bible and explaining my logic, I know what it says, and you can't interpret it that way, and you need the Holy Spirit to translate it for you. And I just, you know, I was like, yeah, that's just being stubborn. You know, I'm showing you the scripture. I'm giving you a logical argument on why tithing has been done away with. And for those that don't know what tithing is, as we touched upon it in the interview with Mitch Hussigen, you know, Jim Jones had him give him 20%.
20%.
Yeah, but in traditional, you know, churches, it's 10% and whatnot. Now, I do believe that if you're going to go to a building and support it and support if they have services that they're offering to the people, survival programs like the Black Panther Party had, that you should give something to it. You know, it takes money to keep the lights on. So to speak, it takes money to put gas in the van that's going to go pick up those that don't have a ride. But when you tell people that, you know, you must give 10%, and if you don't, you are robbing God, you know what I'm saying? Using, again, the Old Testament prior to Jesus Christ. And again, we're just talking about it in context of Christianity.
You're talking about Malachi, what scripture that these preachers beat their congregations over the head with. Will a man rob God? Well, if they really read that scripture for themselves, they would realize that the God of Israel was talking to the Levitical priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't talking to no congregation. The priests were the ones that were rotten. Mm-hmm. So he was talking to them.
So I see that stubbornness.
Over their congregation to beat it over their congregation's head. They don't read, and they're stubborn, and they will tell you straight up, you don't have no authority to tell me that, because I don't have the education. I don't have, you know, I don't have that education,
the
that
doctorate.
Our people so,
mm-hmm.
you know, the miseducation of the Negro. You know, I don't have that education. My education is my experience, man.
Right.
And that education that you get out of these buildings are there to. For capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's all for capitalism.
I'm sorry, Brother Ral, but speaking on some of our past disagreements, it's not so much that I disagree with you that these churches are preying on our community, and I'm not praying for the community, but praying on the community. It's not so much that I disagree with you on that. It's just that, you know, from my experiences, like you're talking from your experience, I have come across a few individuals who are part of a church or lead a church that are into social activism. You know, they do the things that they're supposed to do. They are actually serving the people and not robbing the people and exploiting the people. So it's not that I disagree with you. I'm just saying that there's exceptions to every rule.
Right. But I say, when you try to make a lie the truth, then automatically you're defeating the cause. Like, they just built this church, like, about 2 miles from me. And big church, I mean, big, pretty building. So I asked some of the parishioners that was asking me to attend there, you know, because they think, some strange reason, I must have some Christian ways about me. And they asked me, like, well, why don't you come and visit our church, man? You will like it. I said, does he have a social outreach program?
Mm-hmm.
you know how they lie. Yeah, we got it. I said, well, what is it? Does he have a school set up there for our children?
Right.
Because they're closing these public school systems down. Mm-hmm. That building is so big, it could have a couple of schools in it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, does he have any athletics? Is he setting up athletics in the neighborhood?
Like a mentoring program for the youth.
Right. No, he's inviting Fred Price and people like that to gouge these people for money. That's
mm-hmm.
what he's doing. But it's a big, beautiful building. We could be using buildings like that. I see some, you know, I'm going to tell you something, man. I, you know, people won't get me wrong. But what black people are getting is what they deserve. Because anytime we put money in some garbage like that, instead of putting it in schools, hospitals, our youth, and we give it to a high-priced swindler like that every Sunday proudly, why do you think our neighborhoods continue to look like this, Scotty?
Right.
Why do you think the white man is closing our public schools down, saying like, look, you know, because we haven't learned our lessons yet. We got to stop some of this foolishness. And it's not, and brother, don't get me wrong. It's not that I'm condemning these people, but I see what it's doing to our community.
You're frustrated.
They don't put their money in these white banks. They put them in, they don't put their money in black banks. They give it to a guy that's ahead of a bunch of churches called their spiritual father. And usually, I'll say 9 out of 10 times, their spiritual father is a white man that's getting that money off that black church and he's putting it in his white bank. And we wonder why our communities are still poor.
Right.
You know, it's ridiculous. It's just it sickens me because I saw it firsthand. And it's not that, and that sister just reignited my passion or my disdain for that kind of foolishness. And it really makes me mad. And it's not that I'm condemning the people, because I know for a fact a lot of them just, they lack the knowledge.
Right. They haven't
into
awareness.
Knowledge, and they don't, and they're stubborn and they want to stay stuck. Matter of fact, they want to prove you wrong with their foolishness. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just had to call in to say like, man, she opened up a can of worms there with this Jim Jones thing, because if he was alive today, the same thing would happen over again, man.
Yeah, hey, you know what? If Tim Wise was a Christian pastor, yeah. he'd be the prime suspect. You know what I'm saying? Because I see the similarity
yeah,
between Jim Jones and his followers and the followers of Tim Wise. Do you?
And Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton.
And Bill Clinton.
Man, them black women love it. Them black women
mm-hmm.
love Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
They love this thing that's in the White House now.
Mm-hmm.
They love that. And look what he's done. Look what him and Loretta Lynch has done for us. They're selling on every travesty that happens in our community. But the black women love him because he sang an Al Green song to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, come on, Scotty. Come on, man.
Well, Brother Ralph, that's why we, along with others in the black community, try to produce conscious radio so that we can disseminate this information and facilitate these types of conversations. And while we may not get a person to, you know, right away see what we see, but we are planting seeds, and hopefully they'll come. Because like you said, one time you was caught up in it. At one time, I was caught up in it. And again, this does not mean that I'm anti, you know, people practicing spirituality. I'm anti-religion. I'm anti-religion,
right.
You know, because there's a difference between the two in my mind.
And one more thing. I heard you when you called into the show on Sunday night, and I couldn't agree with you more. Because for them to be calling this thing that we're going through here post-traumatic slavery, and nothing against the author of that book. She has some valid points. I like some of the points she brought up. But don't call it post-traumatic slavery. Because what is traumatizing us at this present age? What has our men locked up in prison for petty crimes and being made merchandise out of by these corporations? So when you come in here and you tell me, so you're telling me that slavery's over? No, this oppression is still going on. It's
mm-hmm.
just that once we become educated, we become blind again. And we think that, you know, all these things back then and our ancestors suffered. the things that these people are doing now, stabbing each other in lines, waiting on Jordans, fighting in these clubs, these world star videos. My grandparents, who were closer to that slavery they're talking about, had more ethics and morals than these young people that's out here in the street now. So what is traumatizing them? It's not slavery. It's not slavery.
That's that media, you know, programming, though. That's that social programming. That is why that's why you have black radio stations disappearing. That's why, you know, you got a so-called...
Most of them need to, though, Scotty.
Well, yeah, they need to now.
They had us thinking that the Democratic Party was our power base, and they see what the Democratic Party has done for us for these last 7 years. Nothing.
Right.
Nothing but turn a blind eye.
Well, I hear what you're saying in terms of they need to disappear, but that's how these young people are getting programmed. I got to give a shout out to Clear the Airways Project up there in Chicago, who are confronting the management of these local radio stations in Chicago that's playing all this murder music, that is playing all of this programming, that is programming our youth to be materialistic, to think that their value is based on what kind of shoes or clothes they are wearing. So, you know, that's that social programming via media. And I hear you in saying that, well, they need to disappear, you know, if they're engaged in that. And I would agree with you. But you know, what I'm saying is it wasn't like that in the 60s. It wasn't like that in the 70s. We was getting real information. Okay. And then, you know, you remember Michael Basedon. You remember his national radio show?
Yeah, I remember him.
You know why he's gone now. You know why he's off the air now, right?
Well, I think it came around that Gina 6 thing.
Exactly. There you go. He started having too many activists and talking about social justice issues too much. You know, some of the activists that have been on Black Talk Radio, he was having on there to talk about, you know, the Scott sisters. He talked about the Scott sisters. He had, you know, Nancy Lockhart on his radio show. And a lot of people was getting empowered through that or getting informed. And now he's gone. He's gone. That's why ABC, because it was through the corporation ABC, one of their media properties, you know, that he had his national program through. And that's why it's gone. But if you want to talk about some strawberry letters and getting some dating advice from a divorcee, you know, and a person who cheated on his wife, you know, and then married his mistress, well, you know, and I'm talking about Steve Harvey, or if you want to talk about somebody that's telling jokes or that is going to promote the Democratic Party like a Tom Joyner, then, yeah, you'll be nationally syndicated, you know. So.
Well, I'm going to tell you something with that Tom Joyner. He just replaced a very conscious he's about to replace a very conscious program that came on every morning, brought on conscious guests, got us in a real dialogue. And the excuse that these white supremacists or Zionists, because you gotta call the flesh and blood that's behind this white supremacy, bro. And so if you look at the owners of ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, you look at them, and you can start to name names, you'll see the flesh and blood behind white supremacy. So we need to start, just like they said, we need to start naming these traitors and these proxy racists in our ranks. We need to name those guys that are pulling the strings on these major networks that's controlling these slaves like Tom Joyner, Steve Harvey, the young girl from The View. We need to see they're only puppets doing what they're told.
Right.
You know, and they have some blame to that. But let's find out who the puppeteers are and start naming them.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I just got to leave with that note, though, brother. But you're doing a good job. You're going to get some donations from me, man. I really appreciate what you're doing because you're keeping it 100. And I even sent a letter out to the 1 million black voters and contributors. Like, forget WOL. That's ran by white supremacists, too. Even though Kathy Hughes is the founder, that's all she is a founder. She's not. She don't even have no say-so in that. White supremacists won that station, man. So, you know, we need to, like, put it behind real black talk radio. Put your money where your mouth is at and and start putting the money where we need to put it. So I already sent a letter to him. I didn't get no responses on it, but I'm going to do it again. You know what I mean? I'm going to send out another one. We need to back up what's ours to get all this other garbage.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. I really appreciate your long time support of the network and your advocacy for the work that we do. And you be blessed, brother.
You too, man. Peace out.
Peace. All right. Let me just address something. There's no need for me to address that in the chat room. Wednesday, I will not be on air Wednesdays. That's why I say I'm on air Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Wednesdays, I usually take that as a mid-week day to take care of some of the things behind the scenes of the Black Talk Radio Network, which is managed by the North Carolina-based nonprofit Black Talk Media Project. And so I won't be back on air until Thursday. I don't take holidays off or anything like that. And we do have, let me go ahead and just pull up the calendar right quick, because I do believe we have a guest scheduled for Thursday. But I am not sure. Yes, we do have a guest scheduled. But I don't have the details on it, so we will have a guest. I'll publish that on blacktalkradionetwork.com, but we will be back on air Thursday at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. Oh, I do have a quick update on a past guest. We had Mr. Joseph on the program, who filed a lawsuit against the Met and the NYC over Aryan Jesus, portraits of Aryan Jesus. And the Met in NYC had a 5 o'clock p.m. deadline to file a response to his lawsuit, which was filed in a federal court. And I checked with him today. They did file a last-minute response, so I'm looking to get an update video interview with Mr. Joseph about that. We're just trying to work out a day. You know, a lot of people during this time of year, you know, they're traveling or they're very busy, you know, working things out with their families and whatnot. So we're just trying to nail down a date when Mr. Joseph can be available and do a quick interview with him, a video interview, which more than likely be published to our YouTube channel. So you can follow our YouTube channel on YouTube, obviously, but the name of the channel is Black Talk Media. Black Talk Media. All right. Again, I want to thank our guest, Ms. Sakivu Hutchison, for joining us again to talk about her book, White Knights in Black Paradise, and the wider subject of Black women, religion, and whatnot, as we were also having that conversation with Brother Ralph, longtime listener and supporter. Okay, so again, recognize this fact that you do live behind enemy lines, controlled by a corporation known as USA Inc. All right, people falsely believe that you live in a country that's ruled by a constitutional republic. It is no longer a constitutional republic. It became a corporation in 1871. Washington, D.C., Congress, that's a corporation. And once you realize that, then, you know, you can understand the cozy relationship that corporation and its corporate officers have with other corporations and their other corporate officers. And so they're still practicing slavery through the 13th Amendment, which did not abolish slavery, contrary to popular myth and, teachings and whatnot. But they did not abolish slavery. If you don't believe me, go read the 13th Amendment, and then we can come back and have a conversation on whether or not you still contend that they abolished slavery. Now, whenever slavery is being practiced in the land, obviously you're going to have a lot of death. You're going to have a lot of destruction, people being kidnapped and stolen labor and whatnot, and casualties are going to be created. It's a battlefield out there, okay? You don't believe me? Go check the database, killedbypolice.net. And so with all these casualties being created all around us, I always try to tell people it is imperative that you develop battlefield awareness, because it is a battle. It's Battlefield America out there, man. So you got to develop battlefield awareness. Some people call it situational awareness, and you need the skills to navigate your way behind these enemy lines, especially if you're a person of color or you live in one of these predominantly poor communities. And so if you develop those skills, then hopefully you can prevent yourself from becoming a casualty and remain alive and help us continue to make this world, make this country, make this nation, make this land, free the land, as some of our revolutionary brothers and sisters would say. All right. So with that said, again, I'll be back on air Thursday. And until then, peace and blessings to all. Y'all be safe out there, okay?
Party people. Party people, say yo get funky. Don't sign it for, say yo get funky. Don't do you later, say yo get funky. Yeah, just hit me. Just hit the funk and hit me. Just get on down and hit me. That body just getting so fucking hot, hit me.
Let your soul lead the way. Shake it down.
Go, ladies.
It's a living dream.